Do you consider impatience to be sin? It is sin. It is sin to be impatient because we are basically being dissatisfied with God when we are impatient. We don't like the circumstances that we are in, the things that we have had to endure. And yet, we have to recognize that God is sovereign over all, so that the things that happen to us are not just random chance, but rather they are brought according to the wisdom wisdom of God for our good and for His glory. Remember that patience is one of those things that is included in the fruit of the Spirit. In other words, we need the Spirit of Christ in order to have true patience. And if we do not have patience, it means that we need to be driven to God in order to have patience through Him, because He gives His Spirit to us so that we may be patient. But impatience is what we might call one of those respectable sins. That is, it's one we can talk about. You know, we don't talk about sexual sins. That's not something that is public to us, or that we want to deal with publicly. But impatience, oh yeah, we can talk about that. You know, sayings that are out there like, "Lord, give me patience, but hurry." And things, you know, to just indicate, well, I really don't like to have to wait. Well, that was a sin that plagued Israel many times. And one of those times is in the book of Numbers, the 21st chapter, where we're getting to the end of the wilderness wanderings. And as we look to the book of Numbers, the verse that we want from the book of Numbers is one that is found in that 21st chapter in regard to the bronze serpent that Moses raised up on the pole so that people would look to it and be healed of the venomous bites that they had received from those serpents. I'm going to read then this afternoon from Numbers chapter 21, the first 9 verses. Hear the word of the Lord. When the Canaanite king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming along the road to Atharim, he attacked the Israelites and captured some of them. Then Israel made this vow to the Lord, "If you will deliver these people into our hands, we will totally destroy their cities." The Lord listened to Israel's plea and gave the Canaanites over to them. They completely destroyed them and their towns, so the place was named Hormah. They traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, he lived. May God bless to us the reading of this portion of His word as we consider it before Him this afternoon. We are to recognize our circumstances as being under the authority and wisdom of God. That's not something that people generally do. You have no doubt heard people speak of how awful their situation is. Everyone's against me. Things are going bad. I can't get anything to go right. Well, is the hand of God in that? Of course it is. And why? What is it that is going on in our lives that makes us end up in that way? I remember way back in my elementary school days, we were moving, it was between my fourth and fifth grade years, we were moving from Albuquerque, New Mexico to Whittier, California. And my father had rented a large trailer that he had attached to our 54 Pontiac. And the man who would become my brother-in-law wasn't my brother-in-law yet, but when he hitched a smaller trailer that Dad owned up to his Studebaker, and we had both of those trailers loaded completely and drove through the night to make this move. Now, this was before, this was in 1958. Eisenhower was the president, and you know that one of the things that President Eisenhower did was that he was the one who set up the interstate system, but it wasn't all built yet. And so we were taking, of course, the two-lane highways through the night, and one of those highways that we were on went through Jerome, Arizona. And in Jerome, Arizona, there was a very steep hill. And my brother-in-law was able to drive up that hill in his Studebaker with the trailer attached, but our Pontiac with the large trailer on it would not go up the hill. And I remember that it was in the middle of the night, maybe, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, that there was my father and the man who would become my brother-in-law and others standing around shining a flashlight on the map and saying, okay, we'll meet you at such and such a place, but we will have to go all the way around here to get there. It could be a very discouraging thing. Now, it didn't bother me that much because I was only 10 years old. But and I could sleep in the car. I didn't have to worry about driving. But I know it was a discouraging thing. And it's the kind of thing that could easily get people to complain. Oh, why couldn't we get up that hill? Well, I want you to consider the circumstances surrounding Israel at the time of this bronze snake being set up, and because of the venomous snakes that were biting and killing some of the Israelites. This is very near the end of the wilderness wandering. The 40 years is coming to a close. And you get the impression that the people are kind of excited finally to get out of the desert and to get up into the land that God has promised them. Now, when they came up out of Egypt, the quick way would have been just to follow the contour of the Mediterranean Sea to get into the promised land, but that's not the way that God was taking them. He was taking them around the Dead Sea, up into the plains north of the Dead Sea, and that they would cross over into Jericho there. Well, Israel had come to the Dead Sea, and the border of Edom was there, and begged Edom, just let us go through. We aren't going to take any of your food. If we get any water, we'll pay you for it, and so forth. And they said, you can't do that. And so it was that they had to go around Edom, and as I figured, it was probably in the neighborhood of an extra 250 miles that they had to travel on foot. You can imagine how discouraging something like that would be. Well, we read that when they left, they notice in verse 4 here of our scripture lesson, They traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea. Think about it. We're now on the route back to where we came from. We had to cross that Red Sea, and that took a spectacular act of God for us to get through there. Just to be going back on that route was in itself a discouraging thing. They left Mount Hor to do this. Well, what had happened at Mount Hor? That's where Aaron had died. This is shortly after the time when they did not have water. They complained against the Lord. Moses struck the rock when God had told him to speak to the rock. And water came out, but God said to Moses and Aaron, "You're not going to go into the promised land because you have not trusted me, you have not honored me." Miriam had just died before this. They came to Mount Hor. Aaron died and was buried there. And then this Canaanite king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, this was part of the people that Israel was to destroy, has come out against them. And Israel says, "Okay, we will devote them completely to the Lord, to destruction. We won't even take any of the spoils of this battle, because we're going to dedicate it all to the Lord." And so the Lord gave them the victory, and they did as they said. And you get the impression that perhaps some of them are thinking, "Well, look at the brownie points that we've got just because we devoted all this to the Lord. And now we can't go through Edom. We have to go these extra 250 miles in order to get to the promised land." We read then, the people grew impatient on the way. And what did that impatience produce? They spoke against God and against Moses. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There is no bread. There is no water. And we detest this miserable food." Dad, if one of the kids complains about this miserable food that your wife has just prepared and put on the table, what do you do? There's going to be some repercussions, aren't there? At least there's going to be an apology to Mom for having complained so much. Well, here God had given them this miserable food, the manna. God had provided for them. He sustained them through the desert. He had done this marvelously when it would seem that the desert should have consumed them. And so now they're on this route toward the Red Sea from Edom in order to get around Edom, to go all this extra distance. It seems that God had brought them on this way to test them once more. Before they enter the land of Canaan, would they trust him? Would they be satisfied with him? But they became impatient and they complained against God. They're just like their fathers were. You look back over the previous 40 years and you find complaint after complaint after complaint instead of being satisfied with God. They did not remember the goodness of God. They didn't remember the things that he had done for them. The marvelous works that he did in those 10 plagues in Egypt. The way he had opened the way for them through the Red Sea. The way he had provided water time after time through the wilderness. And how he had provided for them a way in order to approach him. Instead, they complained because of their impatience. Sadly, that is too typical a response to our circumstances. When things go wrong, when you see circumstances go bad, how do you respond? That's when your trust in the Lord is really tested. To see whether you will be satisfied with Him, to be confident that He has these things in His control, that there are no surprises with Him, and that He will accomplish His purpose. What can we expect from impatience? Well, ultimately, what we can expect is death. We can expect the wrath of God to be poured out when we are dissatisfied with God, who has dealt with us so graciously throughout our lives, who has made us for His glory, and we have often gone our own way. We can expect God to deal harshly with us. And it's only by His grace that we are spared. The punishment seems to have been fitting the crime. He brought these serpents to them. Venomous serpents. We aren't told what particular kind they were. We don't need to know. They had many times wondered, wouldn't it have been better for us to stay in Egypt? Why don't we go back to Egypt? Now, by this time, there aren't so many who remember Egypt because those people have died, except for those who were under 20 when they came out of Egypt. Nevertheless, the people have heard about Egypt from their parents. Some of them probably have had parents that glorified their life in Egypt to say, look how wonderful it was compared to what we have to do here in this desert. Well, Egypt was often symbolized by snakes. The asp. You might recall seeing the pictures of a serpent on the headgear of Pharaoh. But the serpent was also, remember, a very significant thing that was in the life of God's people, going back, of course, to the Garden of Eden, all the way through the book of Revelation. I remember Bill Edgar telling me one time that Dick Weir was examining somebody in regard to his knowledge of the English Bible, and one of the questions he asked was, tell me about all the snakes you know about in the Bible. And Bill said, I thought it was a stupid question, and then I realized, no, that's really a good question, because it's really showing what the fellow knows about the Bible. And the place of snakes is an important aspect of Scripture, not just in Eden, but here in the life of the Israelites, and various other places. How many of can you think of? You know, just in your own mind, go through the different places that you might think of snakes in the Bible. The serpent is certainly a representative of darkness. We find that true of it, not only in the book of Revelation, but Jesus, I think, uses it that way in His ministry. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is responding to those who have said that He's casting out demons by Beelzebub, the ruler of demons. And one of the things that Jesus has to say in response and directly to these people is, you brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say anything good? For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. He calls them snakes, basically, saying, look, you are just like the one who led Adam and Eve astray to do what I had told them not to do. And then later on in chapter 23, Matthew 23, Jesus is pronouncing a number of woes on the Pharisees. And in verse 33, he says, "You snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell?" And of course, when we come to the book of Revelation, we have that serpent of old, the dragon, the devil, who is mentioned. It is a picture of darkness, and that's the way the Israelites have gone by their complaining out of their impatience. They have joined the ranks of those who are in the kingdom of darkness. But this kind of complaint is something that brings death, just like every sin does. He is our provider. He had given them manna there in the wilderness so that they could have food throughout their time. Now, that wasn't the only thing that they had. He had also provided quail for them in the morning, in the evening, and manna in the morning. They had their flocks and herds with them. No doubt they used those flocks and herds for food as well. But here was this trouble that they had to go all the way around Edom, a trouble that they had not anticipated, a trouble that they really did not want, and it led them to another kind of complaint. And that's something that happens among us too, isn't it? That when we have trouble in one area, we begin to complain about things that are going wrong in other areas. Or we begin to see those other areas in a different light and begin to think of them as, you know, things that we can complain about. One kind of trouble should not breed general complaints from us. But that's what often happens in our attitudes, isn't it? Remember how that issue of water, just a short time before this, had disqualified Moses and Aaron. They complained about the people. They blamed it on the people. And now would the rest of Israel die because of their complaints? Certainly some of them died. Others, it seemed, were going to die unless something would happen in order to stop this plague that was brought on them. So Moses goes to the Lord. Actually, one thing that we ought to note in regard to the people that is a wonderful response, and that is they confessed their sin. "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. And here was God's response: "Make a snake and set it on a pole so that anyone who looks at that pole, that snake on the pole, would be healed." Now think about what would happen there. Now Moses makes this bronze serpent, sets it on a pole, and puts it in a place where no doubt it would be easy for people to get to. Some of them may need help getting to it because of the severity of the disease in them. If there are any who don't believe that that's going to work, they're going to die because they're not going to come and look at that serpent on the pole. On the other hand, those who do believe that they will be healed because God has said they would be healed would come and take a look at it. You see, the gift of faith was given to them. And it was because of that gift of faith that they would come and look at the serpent so that they might be healed. But the serpent was not to be looked on as something magical. And yet that seems to be what the Israelites did with it. It seems to be something that they carried with them for quite some time so that it became a source of idolatry. In the days of King Hezekiah, we read about that serpent, because it had been preserved, that bronze serpent, all the way up to this point. And in 2 Kings chapter 18, we read about it. Hezekiah is bringing reforms to the land as he begins to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years and so forth. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan. You see how, as they had been helped according to the direction that God gave Moses, they thought in a sort of magical way that they should keep this with them, that somehow it would help them. And so they were even burning incense to it, and it became a form of idolatry. I'm not sure why we don't read about it in between, you know, Numbers 20, 21, and the time of Hezekiah. But that's one of those things that just kind of goes by the wayside. But we've come to recognize that it was something that they were dealing with throughout their history up to that point. And we're looking at several hundred years would be involved in that. Because if you think of Moses, very roughly around the time of 1500 BC, Hezekiah would be, what, about 800 or so BC? Anyways, you know, roughly 700 years that they had had Nehushtan, or this bronze serpent, with them. But it was only the power of God that brought them healing. As he gave them faith to look on that serpent, it was not that the serpent did anything, it was God himself who granted them healing. And that's what we are taught to seek, the mercy of God and his grace to deliver us. So that when Jesus was talking with Nicodemus, that night that Nicodemus came secretly, apparently, to Jesus, just before that well-known verse, John 3:16, in the 14th verse, we read that as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And you see, the same thing is true of the raising up, the lifting up of Jesus, the lifting up of the Christ, that those who would not just physically look on him, but who would spiritually look to him with the faith that God would give them, would find eternal life. They would be delivered. And that's what Israel needed to recognize from this lesson, from this event. That it's only as they would look to the Messiah, the one who was their Redeemer, it's only then that they would have everlasting life. And so they were taught to look, to seek the one who would be lifted up for them. The God of their circumstances they would come to see then as also the one who is their provider and their healer. The one who would care for them. He was the one who took the punishment as he was lifted up, so that all who would look to him might be healed. They might have their sins washed away. If only Israel would recognize that, and if only we and our communities would see that, that Jesus is the one who was lifted up in order that we might have life. Impatience is sin. and is sin because it is dissatisfaction with God as he brings these circumstances around us. And when we complain about those circumstances, we are complaining against God. But Christ has even taken upon himself the sins of our impatience in order that we might be delivered from him, from them. And it's as you and I rely on him that our hope in him will lead us to be satisfied with him.